You can roughly locate any community in the world somewhere along a scale running all the way from democracy to despotism. One to the democracy end, another somewhere in the middle. Let's find out about despotism. This man makes it his job to study these things.
I am honored to have as a guest this week on Talk Nation Radio, William Bloom, who is, I would say, our leading authority on post-World War II U.S. foreign policy.
Well, for one thing, avoid the comfortable idea that the mere form of government can of itself safeguard a nation against despotism.
Thanks, everybody, for being here, and thanks, Payman, for having us. It's my honor to introduce William Bloom. But it's true, a book, Addicted to War, has been officially now voted unanimously by the San Francisco School Board and to be used by the history teachers, 10th grade for 12th grade, and it's kind of a big deal.
Many observers have found that two workable yardsticks help in discovering how near a community is to despotism: the respect scale and the power scale.
A careful observer can use a respect scale to find how many citizens get an even break. As a community moves towards despotism, respect is restricted to fewer people.
I will build a great, great wall on our southern border, and I will have Mexico pay for that wall. Mark my words. And these are the best and the finest. When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us.
A community is low on a respect scale if common courtesy is withheld from large groups of people on account of their political attitudes. If people are rude to others because they think their wealth and position gives them that right, or because they don't like a man's race.
Look how much African-American communities have suffered under Democratic control. To those I say the following: what do you have to lose?
Or is religion?
I think Islam hates us. There's something there that there's a tremendous hatred there. There's a tremendous hatred. We have to get to the bottom of it. There is an unbelievable hatred of us.
In Islam itself?
You're going to have to figure that out.
I am a real American. Fight for the rights of every man. I am a real American. Fight for what's right. Fight for your life.
A community rates low on an information scale when the press, radio, and other channels of communication are controlled by only a few people, and when citizens have to accept what they are told.
I take the fact that he develops weapons of mass destruction very seriously. I remember the fact that he has invaded two countries before. I know for a fact that he's poisoned his own people. He doesn't believe in the worth of each individual. He doesn't believe in public dissent.
In communities of this kind, despotism stands a good chance. See how a community trains its teachers. And when teachers put such training into practice, despotism stands a good chance. These children are being taught to accept uncritically whatever they're told. Questions are not encouraged.
How can you ask such a question? Have you got a textbook?
Yes, ma'am.
Does it say here that our law courts are always just?
Yes, ma'am.
Then how dare you question the fact? Sit down.
And so we aren't surprised when...
But it must be true. I saw it in this book right here.
And if books and newspapers and the radio are efficiently controlled, the people will read and accept exactly what the few in control want them to. Government censorship is one form of control. A newspaper which breaks a government censorship rule can be suspended. It is also possible for newspapers and other forms of communication to be controlled by private interests. What sort of community do you live in? Where would you place it on a democracy-despotism scale? To find out, you can rate it on a respect scale and a power scale. And to find out what way it is likely to go in the future, you can rate it on economic distribution and information scales. The lower your community rates on economic distribution and information scales, the lower it is likely to rate on respect and power scales, and thus to approach despotism. What happens in a single community is the problem of its own citizens. But it is also the problem of us all, because as communities go, so goes the nation.
I am honored to have as a guest this week on Talk Nation Radio, William Bloom, who is, I would say, our leading authority on post-World War II U.S. foreign policy. He left the State Department in 1967 in opposition to the war on Vietnam. He became the founder and editor of the Washington Free Press, his monthly internet newsletter, The Anti-Empire Report, is essential reading, and his books include Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Interventions Since World War II, Rogue State, A Guide to the World's Only Superpower, and the brand new book, America's Deadliest Export, Democracy. William, thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
You're very welcome. I must hasten to add that my new title, America's Most Dangerous Export, Democracy, some people take that to be something positive, like the U.S. is exporting democracy. And, of course, it's meant facetiously that it's a dangerous export because the means of exporting is through war and other kinds of violence. That's the point which has to be made.
Yeah, it's a problem with books. Most people only read the titles. I called a book War is a Lie, and people accused me of claiming there were no wars. Somehow people have to get to reading chapter one, which is, I think...
No one who goes beyond the title, it doesn't matter anyhow with those people. They're not interested enough, so I don't care.
How do we get more people interested? Very few people, statistically, read books at all. And it seems to me just about all the good information, not just historical analysis and wide-ranging perspective, but even immediate news reports, show up only in books these days, and nobody reads them. How do we get through to people?
If it's only in books, I mean, what you find on the internet is very wide ranging and very much in depth, and much of what's in my new book can be found in my writings elsewhere on the internet. I just added and updated many things. I don't think it's as bad as you say it is. I think people read as much as they always did before, but maybe not as many books, but the internet has replaced many things in our lives, including going to the movies and what have you. It's just we have to live with that.
It is, however, very self-selecting. I mean, people go to the websites that are going to confirm the information they want to know.
People buy books, which are going to. You can say the same about buying books or going to movies. Most people shy away from things they know is sharply contrary to their basic beliefs. I'm the same way, so I mean that hasn't changed. That doesn't mean people don't change from exposure to these media, but they don't jump in to the far end. Someone who's a liberal, whom I'm aiming to make into a radical, that liberal. Is not going to usually buy a book which is obviously from the far right, so that hasn't changed at all. They'll They'll look at things I write, and I'll guide them over further left. That's my ambition.
Well, I think you do an excellent job of it, from what I can determine online and in terms of my own reading of your writing.
Thank you.
One of the things that I like about your writing is that it does, as you say it does, better explain U.S. foreign policy and remove a great many mysteries and conundrums when you look at things from the perspective that the U.S. government simply does not mean well. And this would seem to be a big gap between the liberal and the radical.
That is a key issue for me and for many other people. We've all had the experience of talking to somebody who's not quite where we are, and we give them all the facts and all the arguments, and which are as plain as day to us, and the person is not moved at all. And you wonder why. Are they just stupid, or what is it? It took me years to really understand this. There's a built-in barrier with these people, with Americans. They believe, whether consciously or unconsciously, that no matter what the government does in its foreign policy, they do mean well, no matter how horrible it appears to be with the bombings and the other forms of violence we employ. They will grant them the benefit of the doubt and say that and think that the intentions are honorable. And as long as they cling to that basic belief, it's like talking to a stone wall. You must get past that point, and that's what I aim for in my writing and in my talking, to get past that point of accepting the idea that the U.S. government means well. And often, just the mere fact of my raising this question helps a great deal, because I have found even people on the left had never really thought about this. They're surprised when I mention it, and they say, oh, you're right. That's what people think. And so this has to be a conscious in the consciousness of any leftist activist, that they must play on this issue. They must deal with it.
I think most are perfectly willing to accept that every other government in the world often means ill. Is there any rational basis whatsoever for the exceptionalist view that, you know, because our neighbors mean well and we know some low-level government employees who mean well, that somehow the U.S. government must have good intentions? Is there any basis?
The art of propaganda and indoctrination has reached a very fine, high level of art in America. We are raised from childhood or babyhood on to believe that we are an exceptional country and society. It starts with our comic books and in saying the Pledge of Allegiance when you're in kindergarten, and this moves right up the ladder. You would just look at 2 days ago was Armistice Day. I mean, that's what it used to be called. It's now called Veterans Day.
I call it Armistice Day.
Okay. If you just looked at the headlines in the Washington Post or the lead stories on the radio and TV news, I mean, there were even worse than usual, talking about the sacrifice made by our soldiers. And I feel like asking some of these people, was there ever an American soldier who was not a hero? That they're all heroes, and they all make great sacrifices, and we owe them a great deal. And this is just one day of the year, but every day find some other reason to extol our brave soldiers fighting for freedom and democracy. And this goes on all year long, in one way or another, on TV and on the radio, and it's no wonder that someone raised in such a society winds up as an adult believing very sincerely that his government does indeed mean well. It's no surprise.
There's a government program underway, as I'm sure you're aware, to try to make the Vietnam War look better now, turn it back into a good war.
Actually, I hadn't heard about that. Can you give me an example?
There's a great article in the current issue of the War Crimes Times, which is produced by some members of Veterans for Peace, and I'll get it to you. But the point I was going to make is that it seems to begin with U.S. troops were involved, and U.S. troops are always heroes, and U.S. troops always do good things, and we should be ashamed of ourselves for questioning policy because that amounts to questioning troops. There's a wonderful line in your new book where you write, "Propaganda is to a democracy what violence is to a dictatorship." Can you explain that?
Yeah, a dictatorship needs to use violence or force to keep its people in line. To squelch disaffection. Here we use violence also, but we more often it's propaganda. The kind I spoke about a few minutes ago. It starts very early, and so we can keep the violence to a minimum. Although it's getting worse. I mean, there are so many protesters from the Occupy movement, as one example. And just in the past year, I mean, over 1,000 of them were arrested, and many were beaten up. And sprayed in, right in their face. So it's not the way it used to be. The violence here is increasing a great deal towards protesters.
One of the things that I had to question in my own thinking after reading your writing was the value of racism and bigotry in this propaganda that our government puts out constantly. I tend to think that what we do to brown-skinned nations, we would never do to white ones. And you pulled the example of the bombings of Yugoslavia in the 90s. And
people say we only bomb the third world and people of color and Muslims and so on. And I point out we bombed Yugoslavia 78 days and nights in a row. And the Yugoslavia was a white Christian European nation. So that's as far removed as you can get from the third world person of color. But the only thing which qualifies a nation to be a target of our bombing is that they are standing in the way of the empire in some important way. That's all that counts. We're not racist in that sense.
And yet racist imagery and language seem to be a big part, maybe superfluous, unnecessary, but a part of the propaganda that we've been filled with the past decade or so.
Well, that's not official propaganda. You may be talking about Fox News, but the government, I think in general, is pretty sensitive about avoiding such things, especially with a black president, you know. I don't think that's a big factor.
I think that's a very interesting point that a lot of people should stop and think about. Part of the propaganda that I very much agree with you on and that you expose very well is that's been directed at Iran in recent years, including an endless catalog of lies about Ahmadinejad. Can you sort of review the facts? Is he a Holocaust denier?
Several major myths about the man the past 7 or 8 years. The first one was that he had called for Israel to be wiped off the map, and that was taken to be a threat of armed force by Iran against Israel, when in fact he said he wants Israel to be wiped off the map the way the Soviet Union was. Now the Soviet Union came to an end without violence. So obviously he was not speaking of violence. He was speaking about an historical turning point where Israel would no longer exist, but not because of Iranian violence. So that was the first one of the major myths. And then there was the second major myth about him was that he had denied the Holocaust. And he had never... I challenge people who said that to find me an explicit statement of his calling what we know as the Holocaust to be phony, that it didn't really exist. What he was saying all along was that he was questioning certain aspects of the Holocaust, like the figure of 6 million Jews and some other things he questioned, as do many other so-called Holocaust deniers. I've never yet come across a single so-called Holocaust denier who says explicitly and unequivocally that what we know as the Holocaust never took place. So I'm not saying such a person doesn't exist. In this world of 9 billion people, you can find one of any kind. So I'm sure you can find some nut somewhere who says that the Holocaust never took place. But they're a solitary nut. And Ahmed Danishan is not one of them. In fact, he has explicitly said that he believes it took place. I've quoted this on several occasions. He made a speech at Columbia University in 2007, I think it was, where he said explicitly that he doesn't, he's not saying that. And that was even quoted in the Washington Post one time. But you'll find even people, post columnists, who now say, who refer to him as a Holocaust denier, indicating they haven't even read their own newspaper.
It's remarkable in that the United States and Israel are openly lying about Iran and threatening war on Iran, and instead we have these accusations that in fact the threat is the other direction. It's remarkable to me.
Many aspects of the brainwashing of the American people are remarkable indeed, and it includes many intelligent and otherwise educated people. But foreign policy is the most emotional issue that we face, which is probably why it wasn't mentioned at all hardly in the debates of last month. Well, because besides the fact that the two candidates fully agree on the American empire and its right to exist and its goals, imagine if they had someone standing alongside of them for these debates who was interjecting the kinds of thoughts that you and I are expressing now. It would be an eye-opener for the American people, but that's not going to happen.
Indeed. Do you what sort of a change, if any, for better and for worse, do you think the Obama years have been thus far from the Bush-Cheney years?
In foreign policy, it's worse. It's no change for the better, and it's worse. We are the fact that Obama has a kill list that's so brazen and so heretofore unthinkable, and he hasn't apologized at all. He wouldn't even talk about it if you asked him. In my last anti-empire report, I quote the woman who was the head of the Democratic National Committee. She was
Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
Asked her about this kill list of Obama, and she pretended that it didn't exist. Can you imagine? And the New York Times in May had a very lengthy article on that very subject. So it's very frustrating for people like you and I to deal with, on the one hand, public officials who deny the most basic, simple fact, and on the other hand, an American public who are conditioned to, if they're forced to choose between the likes of you and I and an American politician, they're conditioned to place much more faith in the politician. Even though this is sort of an age of cynicism, and you have many people who hate Congress, the Congress rates on the bottom of the list of the institutions most trusted, but the average American doesn't put two and two together when it comes to such things. When it comes to foreign policy, and the flag is waving, and our brave lads are fighting and dying overseas and coming home wounded, there's just all that they know and are suspicious about and cynical about, it just leaves them. They're so conditioned to not take the side of anybody who's not on the side of our brave boys.
We are speaking with William Bloom, the author of the new book, America's Deadliest Export, Democracy. I saw that brief interview with Debbie Wasserman Schultz in which she responded to a question about the kill list as if she had never heard of it. And I'm not absolutely certain she had ever heard of it.
It's possible. You can't go too wrong if you assume any public official is uninformed. That's very common. But she didn't even show any curiosity. She didn't ask the person who was asking the questions, where did you see this? You know, what is the source of your question? You know, she just assumed there was nonsense and just attempted to ignore him and the question.
Well, he was an independent journalist, not a big corporate organization.
So she was
conditioned to believe he was nuts and irrelevant.
Right. It should have been a reporter from the New York Times, and he could have said it, though it was his newspaper that exposed it.
Indeed, front page story in the New York Times, big media story, lots of publication and additional coverage and discussion, and yet, in my experience, most Obama supporters have never heard of it. They don't support it. They don't tolerate it. They've never heard of it. And I think there's
if they happen to catch the story when it came out, they soon forgot about it because it was too unpleasant to maintain in their memory.
Exactly.
That's what happens very often.
Exactly. You know, you'll probably recall some years back we had polls done by the corporate media outlets that found that a majority of Americans wanted President Bush to be impeached for his abuses. And I have to assume that if he had had such a thing as a kill list and a regular weekly assassination meeting and was picking off men, women, and children, Americans and non-Americans, quite openly and bragging about it, that those numbers would have gone dramatically higher, that we wouldn't have had 70% wanting him impeached. We would have had 90%.
Many of the things people laugh at Bush for, they accept with Obama. The one expression Obama has used half a dozen times is when he's asked about prosecuting Cheney and Bush for war crimes, he'll say, "I prefer to look forward, not backward." Now, each time he says that, I think, imagine an accused criminal standing before a judge in court, and the accused says, "Your Honor, I prefer we look forward and not backward, and forget about what I'm charged with." I mean, it's that silly. If Bush had said this, people's eyes would roll and they would shake their head and they would giggle at this stupid man, George W. Bush. But when Obama says it again and again, it doesn't have the same effect.
He has a whole different set of requirements and expectations. It's seems deadly to our movement that we do this switch based on party. I have to mention that your new book, America's Deadliest Export, Democracy, goes into a whole range of topics, including a chapter on capitalism that is simply brilliant and is almost a series of aphorisms, and I can't recommend it more highly. What is the role of capitalism in our propaganda and in our empire these days?
Well, it goes alongside God and country. God, country, and capitalism. Those are the things which an American does not compromise on. And if those are the things which are each one individually or individually or together, is reason enough to fight a war and kill people. Those are all noble causes. And it's so ironic. They keep the Republicans or other people on the right keep calling Obama a socialist, because that to them is the worst insult they can think of. The man is a socialist. You know, if only that were the case. But it's so stupid. He has spoken about in favor of capitalism on many occasions. I've never come across a single line from him in favor of socialism. If Obama had been a Republican, and he had said and done the exact same things he's done the past 4 years, he would be regarded well by people on the right. But because he's a Democrat and because he's black, it doesn't matter. He's doomed to be criticized, and they don't care that what he's saying is not per se leftist, and what he does is not leftist at all. He's at best, by the standards of Europe, he would be called a center rightist. At best, that's what he is. And yet, you would think that the Republicans should be happy to have such a man in power. But they're blinded by the fact that he's a Democrat and a black man, and it's not them in power. And so they make up all kinds of criticisms which have no relevance or basis in fact. And as I said, if their own party member was doing the same thing, they would have no problem accepting that.
And yet we all, I think, including all of the supporters of Obama and the Democratic Party, have a very hard time accepting what you've just said. But I think their eyes could be opened more widely by reading the Anti-Empire Report every month and reading this wonderful new book, America's Deadliest Export, Democracy. We've been speaking with William Bloom. William, thanks very, very much for being on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, engineered by Christiane Brown in Reno, Nevada, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. Until next time.